I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guests are writers Helen Epstein and Elizabeth Rosner. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Helen Epstein and Elizabeth Rosner.
Most of us are familiar with the obligation to remember. But the best way to do that when it comes to atrocities is another question. How do we carry the stories of trauma forward? How does it live in our bodies and in the bodies of our children? These are some of the questions that our guests this evening wrestle with professionally as writers and personally as children of Holocaust survivors. Helen Epstein is a veteran arts journalist and the author or translator of 10 books of nonfiction, including Children of the Holocaust and Where She Came From, A Daughter's Search for Her Mother's History. Born in Prague in 1947, she grew up in Manhattan and graduated from Hebrew University and the Columbia School of Journalism. Her profiles of major cultural figures such as musicians Vladimir Horowitz and Leonard Bernstein have appeared in the Sunday New York Times, many magazines, and the book Music Talks. Her latest book is the third part of her Holocaust trilogy and is titled The Long Half-Lives of Love and Trauma. She lives in Lexington, Massachusetts. Elizabeth Rosner is an internationally award-winning novelist, poet, and essayist whose books have been translated into 10 languages. Her first novel, The Speed of Light, won Hadassah Magazine's Ribolo Prize, judged by Elie Wiesel. Born in Schenectady, New York, she's the daughter of two Holocaust survivors, and much of her work is inspired by the impact of their experiences on her imagination and identity. Her newest book, Survivor Cafe, The Legacy of Trauma and the Labyrinth of Memory, published in fall 2017, was featured on NPR's All Things Considered and in the New York Times. Her book reviews frequently appear in the San Francisco Chronicle. She holds degrees from Stanford, UC Irvine, and the University of Queensland in Australia, and she lives in Berkeley. Please join me in welcoming Liz and Helen to the JCCSF.
Thank you, Stephanie. Welcome, everyone. It's wonderful to see all your faces out there. I actually want to begin by doing a very quick poll of the audience because Helen and I are curious about you. We're very curious about each other, but we're also curious about you. And I've heard that among descendants of Holocaust survivors, we are vastly overrepresented in two fields, in psychotherapy and in the arts. So I'm just really curious, are there psychotherapists in the audience? Okay, not a scattering, so like maybe half a dozen. Artists, more artists, maybe a dozen or more artists.
Okay. And don't forget people who've been in psychotherapy.
Okay, all the hands are going to go up now. and slightly more seriously, how many of you have a direct family connection to the Holocaust? So that's a large number of people in the audience. Thank you. That's helpful for us to hear. Thank you.
So shall I start?
Yeah.
So Liz and I have just met a couple of days ago, and one of the things that occurred to me, having worked in this field for so long, is that people are always telling me, well, your sample is not representative. So I wanted to make sure that you knew the differences between Liz and myself. So we are 12 years apart. I was born at the very end of 1947. She was born at the very end of 1959.
Last day of the 50s, I say. Yeah.
I am a firstborn parentified child. Liz is a secondborn, rebellious, wild child. My family was blatantly secular. My mother, in fact, was baptized as a child. Her name was Franziska Paulina Margaret Rabinek. Liz's family was on the Orthodox end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And so to give you a sense of our differences, we're going to start with talking a bit about our backgrounds, where our parents came from, where they settled, and how we see them on the Jewish spectrum. Hmm. So Liz, you want to start with where you were born?
Sure. You heard Stephanie mention that I was born in Schenectady, New York, which the nickname for the town was Electric City because it was the home of GE. So my parents ended up there when they came to America after a few years of being in America because my father was recruited as an electrical engineer to work there. But they actually met, I'm working my way backwards now, they met in Sweden as refugees. My father had been in the Buchenwald concentration camp as a teenager until it was liberated. And prior to that, he had been in an orphanage in Hamburg with two of his younger brothers. His parents had divorced in 1936. And even though all three children were born in Hamburg, they were actually technically considered Romanian citizens because my grandfather was Romanian. And their Romanian citizenship actually ended up saving their lives. So we could spend the entire evening just talking about the Holocaust part of the story, but my mother was born in Vilna, and she, at the age of 9, along with her parents, were herded into the Vilna ghetto, and they lived in the ghetto until it was liquidated. That word always deeply disturbs me. They managed to survive the liquidation of the ghetto and go into hiding in the Polish countryside. And they were there until the Russians liberated Poland. And strangely, in 1944, just as my mother was being liberated from her hiding place, that was when my father, they didn't know each other yet, he was being deported to Buchenwald concentration camp. So they met as refugees in Stockholm. They fell in love and went to Israel. They got married in Israel and then came to America. And I and both of my siblings were all born in upstate New York, supposedly to live happily ever after as American children in the new reinvented life that my parents had made for themselves. My father wanted to be Orthodox, even though he hadn't been raised in a religious home himself. Mm-hmm. So we belonged to the tiny Orthodox community of Schenectady, New York. In one of my novels, I have a character as a stand-in for me saying, "We were the most Jewish Jews in Electric City," because that was what it felt like to me. And as Helen mentioned, I was the second daughter, and then my brother was born 6 years after me. And, I don't look like a rebellious person right now, but I was definitely sort of the troublemaker in the family, but it was all relative because my sister was an honors student, and rebelling in the wake of that just meant I got A's instead of A pluses, you know. So rebellious, you know, with rather big quotation marks around it, I would say.
So my parents were both from Czechoslovakia. My father actually was born when Czechoslovakia was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1904. And my father was from the country. He was a jock. He was a water polo player who represented Czechoslovakia in two Olympic Games. He played in the Berlin Olympics of 1936. And the great story about that is that his teammates who were barraged with anti-Semitic propaganda said that if Epstein doesn't go, the whole team doesn't go. And so it's a strange story about the Berlin Olympics because there was this international boycott, but the Czech team went, and it went with my father. And so in 1936, he was in Berlin in the Olympics. My father was also a lieutenant in the Czech army. His garrison was Terezin, which was a military garrison before it was a concentration camp. And he was deported there as in one of the first transports. Because it was his garrison, he was made a quartermaster in the camp because he had been a quartermaster in the Czech army in that camp. And he survived the war first in Terezin. He was in Auschwitz only for 2 days, thank goodness. And he went to a work camp. He was sent to a work camp and survived the war with his two very close friends, one of whom became the conductor of the Toronto Symphony, Karel Anscherl. And apparently the story was in my family that they survived the war by giving each other lectures on their respective areas of expertise. So my father heard a lot about classical music, and Karel Anscherl heard a lot about water polo. I don't know what the third guy did. So that's my father. My mother was a dress designer. My mother was a city chick. She was a Prague girl, very, very sophisticated, very slick, spoke 4 languages, went to the lycée in Prague, dropped out to become a dress designer. 2 very different people who would have never married had it not been for the war. They got married after the war. My mother had been married. They met in Prague on the street in 1945 after they both returned from the camps. My mother was in Auschwitz much longer than my father. Then she was also in a work camp. My mother was liberated by the British at Bergen-Belsen, my father by the Russians at his work camp. They got married in 46. I was born in 47. The communist putsch happened in February 48. My father famously said, "The communists are Nazis in a different color uniform. We are leaving in swimsuits if necessary." My mother was a left winger. She didn't want to leave. My father slapped her. She walked around the block in the snow, came back and said, "We're leaving." And we wound up in New York City in August of 1948, where I grew up. My father came from a traditional Jewish family. My grandfather was the president of a synagogue and the choir master. And my mother, as I said, was baptized, very secular family. I grew up on the Upper West Side of New York, and whereas Liz was the most Jewish of the Jewish community, we were on the very, very, very fringes of the Upper West Side Jewish community. I was sent to Stephen Wise Free Synagogue, but every Sunday morning, my athlete father would take us ice skating in Central Park instead of going to Sunday school. Very, very different families.
And some of that, I think, you know, we've been aware because we've been reading each other's work that that you can see these creeping influences of our different backgrounds in the way we approach the work. And that's, I think, what we're going to get onto next is this whole question of how did all of that lead us to become the writers we became? And, you know, I think for both of us, it's pretty clear that the subjects chose us in a way rather than our, you know, sitting down one day and thinking, gee, what shall I write about? Well, I guess I could write about the Holocaust. To me, it was always clear that that was what I was meant to write. And so far, I haven't stopped. But do you want to give us some background about your...
how we started writing?
Yeah.
So in my case, I thought I was going to do something in music. You know, I grew up in Manhattan. I loved musicians. I played lots of instruments. I sang. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but I majored in music at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And in the summer of 1968, having been a student in Jerusalem that year, I hadn't been reading the newspapers. I had no idea what was going on in the world. I was very immersed in my studies. I went hitchhiking with a bunch of friends of mine through Greece, what was the Yugoslavia, through Vienna, to Czechoslovakia to visit Prague, where I had been born. I got to Prague on August 16th, 1968. I get chills just saying this. And 5 days later, the Russians invaded. So there I was. There was all this symbolic stuff because it was 1968. In 1938, those of you who know your history know, was the Munich Pact when Czechoslovakia got sold down the river. In 1939, Hitler's armies invaded Czechoslovakia. And here we were in 1968, and the armies were coming from the other side. And I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I was in the home of people who had been in concentration camp with my father, who, of course, felt terrible that here was this American child caught in another invasion. And they said, "We're occupied, we're occupied." And in Czech, the word occupied, like in French, means busy. So I said, "Oh, that's okay. No, I can manage." And they said, no, "We're occupied by the Soviet army." And I tuned in and I heard the planes overhead and the tanks in the street, and I heard shooting. I was right in the middle of Prague. And they said, I'm sorry, we have to leave. Don't go out of the house, right? Mm-hmm. So what do? I, of course, get dressed and go out of the house. And I went down to the avenue and saw all the tanks and heard all the stuff. And I was totally, totally dissociated. I did not feel anything. I thought, wow, this is intense. And I went back to the apartment, and there was a typewriter there. And this is how I became a published writer. I sat down at the typewriter, and I had written a couple of columns for my high school newspaper. I went to Hunter High School in New York, and I set the margins at 30-60, as they had told me to do. And I got some carbon paper, because I was already thinking, you know, if I send this somewhere, probably the first person's not going to take it, so I'll have two copies. And I typed up a first-person account of the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia from this apartment as it looked from out the window and over the radio and in the sky, etc. And I found some envelopes, and I addressed one to the New York Times and one to the Jerusalem Post because I was a student in Jerusalem. And, of course, I couldn't mail them because, you know, there was no way of doing anything. And in 2 days later, I got evacuated to Paris. And when I got to Paris, I got off the train, and I spoke fluent French. And I said immediately to everyone I saw, I'm a student in Israel. I just came from Czechoslovakia, and I need stamps. And some people gave me stamps. I mailed the two versions of this piece and put them into a boîte de lettres. And in those days, everybody flew on Icelandic Airways from Luxembourg. So I went to Luxembourg. There was no jetway. We were all standing on the tarmac, like in Casablanca. And this was the turning point in my life. I'm standing online there, and in front of me are two Israeli people who are speaking in Hebrew, and one is saying to the other, did you see that article in the Jerusalem Post by that girl who was in an apartment in Prague? And that's how I became a journalist. And I when I got back to Jerusalem, because I was still a student, they paid me and they hired me as a part-time reporter. And I was 20. And I've never stopped writing for publication since then. So it's a great
story.
That
is an amazing story. It's a great story. I have nothing nearly as dramatic as that. I'm a writer. I should just make something up right now. I said recently in an interview that in many ways you could say that my most recent book, Survivor Cafe, began in utero. Because people often ask writers, you know, did you always know you were going to be a writer? And in a way, like you, I was in the arts. See, that's why I asked about the arts. So I wanted to be a musician and a dancer and an actor. And, you know, I just had a lot I wanted to emote and express creatively. And when I say it all began in utero, what I mean by that is that I really do think that as I go into great length about in my book, I was already receiving a lot of information about what I was carrying from my lineage, from my parents and my grandparents and on back there behind them. And so I think that impulse to emote and express and create for me was that I was trying always to process information, material, stories, as well as silences and secrets and the things that were being sort of whispered about in languages I couldn't understand. Mm. So I grew up with parents who were multilingual, but English was what we all had in common. My parents' secret language was Swedish. It was the language they had fallen in love speaking, and it was the language that they continued to speak in when they didn't want us to know what they were talking about, which was usually us. So, of course, I was insatiably curious to know what they were saying about me. And eventually I ended up spending time in Sweden especially to figure that out. But it was also, there was a forbidden language. That was German, my father's native language. And then there was Russian, which my mother spoke with her mother when her mother came to visit, and then there was a smattering of Yiddish, and then there was, and my father didn't speak Russian or Polish. Polish and Russian were my mother's two first languages. So there was the phone ringing, and I would never know what accent I was going to hear on the other end when I picked up the phone, but it was always accented something.
You're listening to writers Helen Epstein and Elizabeth Rosner talking about the intergenerational aftermath of genocide and how their families' pasts shaped their own lives and the writers that they became. On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And yet, you know, my parents really wanted to assimilate, that magic word that we're hearing again in code now, but we had English in common. And, of course, my siblings and I were all learning English in school. My sister studied French, so that meant I had to do something other than that, so I studied Spanish. But those languages didn't match the rest of the family either. So English was my language, but it was very influenced by the musicality of these other languages that I was always hearing. So my mother also had this very creative way of speaking English sometimes, where I have some poems in a poetry collection where I quote her as saying things like, you'll pass with swinging colors. They were just a little off, but they were kind of better than the, you know. Or she would say, don't cut off your neck to spite your face. And, you know, I would really have to think about that one for a while. And it's a doggy dog day. That was another one. I had no idea what that meant. But so there was this sort of beautiful, you know, kaleidoscopic set of sounds in the air all the time. And then there were these stories that were sometimes interrupted by crying or stories that could barely be told, and then the subject was changed. Or there would be people visiting and people, again, sort of murmuring and muttering in languages that were also about, let's not have the children be listening right now to these stories. And so I think I just really wanted to know everything about everything. I just really especially wanted to know what I wasn't supposed to know. And I think, you know, you can say that that's sort of a classic childhood's curiosity. But in my case, it meant that I asked a lot of questions. And I think of myself as a writer who's continually asking questions, both internally and externally, and that once I realized that writing was going to be the best way for me to sort of gather and collect and shape everything that I was learning and figuring out, and that for me it really meant it was the best use of my mind and my heart. Even though I really danced a lot and I wanted to be a dancer, there was something about dancing that felt like I wasn't as present with my mind as I wanted to be. And so writing really sort of fell into that perfect sweet spot for me of gathering the stories I was hearing but also adding my own stories. And so when I was writing fiction, it was a chance for me to sort of write the stories that might have happened. Or, for example, once I really figured out that I could have been Swedish, you know, if my parents had stayed in Sweden, or if they'd stayed in Israel, I could have been an Israeli. So would I be me if I were there? Or, you know, what version of me would I have been? And or what was it like, for example, when I met people who said, my parents never told us about what happened to them during the war. When I was 18, I found out my parents had been in camps. And that stunned me because I felt, as I said, like I already knew as I was being born that these terrible things had happened. And so I became very curious. My first novel was me writing about a family in which it wasn't spoken about.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. When did you write your first piece about the Holocaust and your legacy? and what prompted it?
Well, so this is one of the ways we connected long before we met. So when I was in graduate school in my early 20s at UC Irvine, I got an honorarium, a research honorarium, to go to Europe and meet the people that my parents had known when they were living in Sweden. And I wanted to sort of piece together those parts of the story. And this Swedish couple said to me, "Oh, your father was very lucky he got out in time." And I said, "What do you mean he got out in time?" And they said, "Oh, he was very lucky he never got sent to a concentration camp." And I said, "He was in a concentration camp. He was in Buchenwald from age 15 to 16. And they said, "Oh, no, no, he wasn't. We would have known that." And I said, "Well, I know that. You know, I'm his daughter, and I do know that that happened." And then I was just spinning with this notion that either they had forgotten, or maybe he didn't talk about it with them because it was so recent. And so I suddenly started putting together the pieces of my childhood with the stories that might have been left out of what my parents' experience was right after the war when they met. And the first piece I wrote was a poem, actually, although I didn't know it was a poem, but it was called Chocolate, and it was about my father hoarding chocolate. And it felt so emblematic of just everything, about the sort of the hunger that my parents had. And then I went back to my graduate program, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm in a fiction program. I'm supposed to be making things up. So I started trying to weave together the truth and the imagination, and it failed badly. I should let you know that. But gradually I came back to the autobiographical material, and I tried getting it published, and they said, "Well, Helen Epstein has already written that book." Yeah, they did. There was just one book needed on the subject at the time, and you had already written it. And so I, you know, kind of dejectedly sat with that for a little while, trying to figure out what was I supposed to do? You know, I knew they were wrong, of course, that as brilliant as your book was and still is, it's still in print after all these decades, and it's still an incredibly important book for most of us who are descended from survivors and for all sorts of people who don't have that lineage, too. But I still felt like I had something to add to the conversation. And so I kept on writing, but I did write novels for a while. And this book of nonfiction was really my chance to come back to that place of really speaking in my voice from my core sense of storytelling. Yeah, so.
So we thought we'd read you a little bit from both books so you'd get a sense of our different voices. And we had a hard time figuring out what to read. But so we asked each other what some of our favorite parts of each other's work was. And from this last book of mine, which took me 15 years to write, and which has been rewritten about 12 times, it's a book that pushes the whole psychotherapy part of being a child of Holocaust survivors. And it goes into it's the most personal of my books. The first book, Children of the Holocaust, was very journalistic. I interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, did a lot of research. The second book, Where She Came From, was heavily, heavily researched. It really is a history of Jewish women in Central Europe as seen through the prism of three generations of my family. So this last book about the Holocaust, the last part of the trilogy, I really wanted to write a memoir, and I wanted to really not do any outside research and really delve into my own life. And so I chose to enter psychoanalysis. I was in psychoanalysis three separate times. I quit the first two times, and then I went back 20 years later. And so the book is, in large part, describes the psychoanalytic process for me. And the part I'm going to read, at Liz's suggestion, is when I entered the first time. So in 1979, when I was 31 years old, I began psychoanalysis for the first time. The day before my first session, my mother invited me to lunch. She was already seated in the cafe, cigarette in hand, when I arrived. When I leaned over to kiss her, she said, "I'm going to save you a lot of time." I was accustomed to my mother's brusque greetings, but this was unusual, even for her. "You'll stop talking to me very soon," she said. I was in psychoanalysis, I know. "So I'll tell you now. I had an affair with Ivan." Who was Ivan? Ivan was my Czech nanny's husband. After we emigrated to New York, my father could not find work, my mother worked full-time, and I needed a nanny. My nanny Milena and her husband Ivan were prominent but penniless anti-Nazi and anti-communist Czech refugees. My mother said that she had hired Milena and fallen in love with her husband. "I had been 3 years old," she said, "when I discovered their affair. She and Ivan had been sitting together at the foot of my bed when I had chickenpox and a high fever, and I had said, 'You two look like you're married.' I told her I had no recollection of that." "How about when I was 6 or 7, she continued. "My mother told me that when I was riding my bike in the park, I ran into her and Ivan holding hands. I didn't remember that either. But when she asked if I remembered breaking my arm in second grade, I felt the sensation of falling. I remembered an overpowering nausea and a white plaster cast that set my arm at a right angle and extended from my wrist almost to my shoulder. Ivan and I were on our way to Cape Cod that afternoon," she said, "the only time we were able to get away together. I didn't think I ever knew that either. I was too stunned by my mother's revelation to tell her that I didn't want to hear this the day before I was supposed to start my psychoanalysis. As far back as I could remember, though, it had been my job to listen to her, and at 31, I was still doing it."
Mm. That's great. Yeah, we can applaud. You know, I'm guessing that a lot of people are familiar with Helen's first book and maybe her second as well. And what I really am so struck by in this book is, you know, then in Children of the Holocaust, you were clearly a groundbreaking writer. You were taking on this territory that hadn't really ever been named yet. And even though we now are so familiar with that language and those concepts, that it's hard to remember what it was like for that book to be brand new and saying something. And really, I think that's why the response I got when I was trying to submit my work was, "Oh, well, that's already been done," because it was so important and it said so much. So in this book, you are breaking ground again. You're taking on the territory of trauma, in this case, sexual trauma. And that's kind of, you know, not taboo anymore exactly, but we're still trying to figure out how to talk about these things. And so I really credit you with, again, sort of leading at the edge of that that movement. Yeah.
Thank you. It was very hard to get any attention to this book. I submitted it to 40 publishers and got 40 rejections. So this was a very, very tough sell. But I think Liz and I are very interested in the issue of language. And how do you articulate experience that has not been articulated in the public domain before? Mm-hmm. In the case of sexual abuse, sexual assault, sexual molestation, sex in general, the culture has changed so much in our country over the last century, and certainly in the last year with the Me Too movement and mm-hmm. the Time's Up movement. But one of the things that Liz has been doing, and which really interests me a lot, is that she's extended the whole conversation around massive trauma, such as the Holocaust, to other cultures that have experienced genocide. And one of the things that I was struck by very much in her current book is the different cultures that she talks about And they're descendants of the generation that was traumatized. And I was particularly struck by the whole Japanese experience after Hiroshima, which, of course, was contemporaneous to the Holocaust. And I wanted to ask you if you could read something from that.
Thank you for that segue. So the idea in this book is that I really am doing this dangerous thing, somewhat dangerous thing, which is writing about the Holocaust, but in the context of how it connects with atrocities and genocides across time and place. Not because I'm comparing and not because I'm creating a hierarchy, but because I feel that actually we have an opportunity for empathetic understanding and a sense of our collective inheritance the more that we do this, the more that we recognize that our individual legacies can bring us closer to tolerating and accepting what each other carries. And so I began exploring the Japanese experience of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and part of that was driven at the very beginning by my interest in the word survivor. And there's a chapter in this book called The S Word, where I really try to unpack all of my confusion and a lot of other people's sort of blurriness around what is that word survivor. And it relates to the title of this book as well, Survivor Cafe, but I'm just going to read you a little bit about some Japanese language. There is a Japanese word for people who lived through the August 1945 nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They are called hibakusha, which usually translates as bomb-affected people. It's estimated that the combined death toll from the two cities is approximately 250,000. Most of the victims' names are recorded in something called the Book of the Past, stored in a stone chest beneath the memorial cenotaph in Hiroshima. Nearby, a memorial mound contains ashes of the estimated 70,000 nameless dead. Of the known hibakusha, who numbered around 280,000, only one man has been officially recognized by the Japanese government as having survived at ground zero of both blasts. Tsutomu Yamaguchi, who lived to the age of 93, was called by some media reports the luckiest and unluckiest man to have ever lived. The most literal Japanese word for survivor, seizonsha, is rarely used by anyone other than scientific investigators. Even more relevant, Japanese often avoid using the term seizonsha in connection with Hiroshima or Nagasaki, because it emphasizes the idea of remaining alive, as in fortitude, with the implication, this is the key part, with the implication that this is unfair to the less fortunate people who were killed. And I talk about that quite a bit in my own family. My father will often say, for example, that he wants everyone to know when I speak about his experiences that he was in Buchenwald, not in Auschwitz. You know, and my mother was in hiding, not in a camp. And this kind of differentiation and people's discomfort with that S word. So there's one more word I want to introduce into the conversation. A project called Hibakusha Stories is devoted to sharing survivor testimonies in the name of educational awareness, actively entrusting young people with remembrance responsibility. These trained storytellers are referred to as denshosha, the designated transmitter of memories. While some of these denshosha are the offspring of survivors, their adult children as well as their grandchildren, others are Japanese citizens unrelated by blood. They are simply, or not simply, choosing to take on this intimately personal role in honoring the collective past. The biggest challenge is how to tell a story about someone's experience in someone else's words, said Ayami Shibata, the city official in charge of the 3-year-long program. Many find it difficult to decide whether to speak first person and which parts of their mentor's life to focus and to inherit. Can successors pass on the words that come out of our souls, something so painful, our experiences and thoughts and feelings, one Hibakusha said? One of the Denshosha is passionate about spreading the message. That's something that I'd like to applaud. That's something that I want him to carry on doing.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writers Helen Epstein and Elizabeth Rosner talking about the intergenerational aftermath of genocide and how their families' pasts shaped their own lives and the writers that they became. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So to me, that raises the whole question, not just of language, but of whose responsibility is it to keep these stories alive? How much of it really rests on that relationship, that intimate bloodline, and how much of it really belongs to all of us communally? And that's why in my book I also talk about the Rwandan genocide and the Armenian genocide and the mass murder by the Khmer Rouge of Cambodians and war in general. I was speaking to somebody just today who's a veteran who said he doesn't differentiate between veterans of the war in Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan. He just calls them veterans of the war, as in the war that we are all afflicted by, and in an ongoing way. You know, wars technically begin and end, but the war goes on. And in that same way, I think, you know, the subject that you and I have written so much about, both personally and collectively, is this subject that really does belong to all of us, I think. And so the question for me that's super urgent right now, especially, is what do we do as the survivors themselves are passing away? How does the memory continue to remain deeply personal and intimate and individual, even as it continues moving beyond the personal into this sense of the historic and the collective historical trauma and resilience and perseverance and all the other things that come with those stories, the stories of heroism, the stories of solidarity, and people doing remarkably brave things to save the lives of others. Those are parts of the story, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the questions we both get a lot is how come we keep writing about this stuff? Yeah. How often do you go to the well? How come it's not over for you? I particularly hear this from my two brothers who aren't interested in this at all. Mm. And I think what hasn't been stressed enough, perhaps, and that Liz and I both are fervent believers in, is the diversity of reactions to the war. There are many people who are descendants of Holocaust survivors, camp survivors, who still don't know that their parents or their mm-hmm. grandparents were in concentration camps or in the war or were Jews at all. Mm-hmm. There are other people who know and don't want to think about it. And there are other people who use the Holocaust for a variety of political purposes, everywhere from the extreme left to the extreme right. So you can't talk about one particular reaction to this history or one particular lesson learned from mm-hmm. this history. There are mm-hmm. many lessons that people take from it, many different reactions to it. And we just represent one very small part of this spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think what you're saying also applies to the concept of trauma, right? So that, every day now we are in a state of collective trauma, I believe, and I don't need to explain why, but I think that word is becoming so ubiquitous that it's as though we all, you know, theoretically agree what we mean by that, but I don't think we really all agree exactly, and that for example, what Helen just said about Holocaust survivor families, the ways that some spoke about it all the time, some spoke about it never, everything in between. One of the complicated definitions of trauma and PTSD that I explore in my book, after interviewing some people who specialize in treating traumatized families, is that there is the kind of trauma that invades constantly into your experience, so that you referenced your own dissociation when you were experiencing the invasion of Prague, that inability to function in the present because you're being so intruded upon by the past that you have to kind of go into a state of shutdown, a state of numbness. On the other hand, there are people who just keep pushing it away so completely that they have no access to the memory at all. And then there's everything in between. One person doesn't necessarily have the same experience of traumatic residue all the time. So I know, because you raised your hands, there are therapists in the audience, many of whom probably know all sorts of things about the current research into trauma and how to heal trauma, how to address trauma, how thoroughly can someone be healed from severe trauma? And then there's also the question that I address in my book about this relatively new field of science called epigenetics, which many of you may have heard about, which is what appears to be the transmission of modified expression of DNA to subsequent generations, so that third and fourth generation descendants of traumatized people are behaving as though they themselves were traumatized. They're exhibiting signs of PTSD when they themselves have not lived through traumatic episodes. So there's a lot we're still trying to understand about this spectrum that you talk about, the different ways of speaking about, experiencing, moving forward in life with your material. And so, you know, you can say, I mean, I know for me, each time I finished a book, I thought, I've exhausted my own relationship to this subject, and then lo and behold, you know, the kaleidoscope tips a little and a new angle seems to enter in. So I think this question of why the subject won't leave us alone is that, for me anyway, the subject keeps connecting to other subjects. You know, these bigger questions of the future for me. What happened once upon a time when the last living slave passed away? How did that change our ability to talk about slavery? Then we had lynching and Jim Crow. You know, the conversation needed to continue, but somehow didn't have the same urgency when slaves were no longer present. What is going to happen to the conversations about the Holocaust when the firsthand witnesses aren't present? How do we become the den shosha, then, the designated transmitter of those memories? So this is, you know, a really direct connection to what I'm just saying. What is your recommendation for conveying the importance, gravity of the Holocaust to those yet to be born, future generations, who won't have the benefit of hearing from those who experienced the Holocaust? So that is why we write, in a way. I know that there's that huge body of oral testimony that's been recorded by the Shoah Foundation, Steven Spielberg, who has committed, you know, vast resources to these projects. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have actually heard a survivor speak in person at some point in your lives? Okay. So are you aware, that's almost everybody, thank you. Are you aware that they are now creating holograms of survivors speaking? I find that a little creepy, I have to say. But on the other hand, you know, as this questioner is inquiring, you know, is that going to be almost the same as being in the room with someone? Because I do really feel that there's something palpable that's different from hearing a testimony in audio form or watching a film, seeing, you know, sitting across the table. The Survivor Cafe that the title of my book references is these seated around tables conversations with survivors in real time. You know, when you see the look in someone's eyes who's lived through something that's essentially unspeakable, even though we try to find language for it, how will that change when there's a hologram that sort of stirs to life? Have any of you, I've seen one. Have you seen it yet? They're very weird, I have to say. But maybe that's because I know there still are living alternatives. Maybe it won't be weird after a while.
I have a good question here, which is a very provocative question. Hasn't the notion that trauma can be epigenetically transmitted been thoroughly debunked? It may be an excellent metaphor, but what is the credible evidence or creditable something? I think that's a great question because I have questions. It's my question also. Mm. I've read a lot about epigenetics. I've met Rachel Yehuda, who started studying epigenetics in Holocaust survivor populations in New York City. I live near Cambridge, Massachusetts, where there's a lot of neuroimaging going on right now with trauma. And there has been some epigenetic work there, too. I don't really understand it. I listened to Rachel Yehuda, who's the person who started doing this with Holocaust survivors. I really couldn't follow what she said. But clearly there are many different people now studying epigenetics in different populations. She is working with American veterans. There's another study that was done with Irish famine survivors. And there are many people all over the world researching this. Apparently, there's at least one book that explains it, but I haven't read it. So while it is a very compelling metaphor, it also is under scientific study at the moment. It's just that I can't tell you whether it's for real or not.
Well, I do talk about it in my book, but I think sometimes people mistake me for being the defender of the science, and I'm not a scientist, I'm not a geneticist, I'm not doing that research myself, but I do think what it raises is the question of, you know, are behaviors predetermined by our genetic code? And, you know, and then some people start to say, oh, you're debunking Darwin by talking about epigenetics. Now we're back to Lamarck saying that, you know, behaviors are, or genetic modification is acquired and then transmitted. I think what we're really talking about is predilections, tendencies, potential for trauma to be expressed multigenerationally, as well as the possibility that it's not going to be present multigenerationally. We don't know enough yet. It's early in these studies. Humans don't reproduce quickly enough. The studies were originally done with mice. Mice reproduce very fast, as you may or may not know. But the point is, the investigation is what's important, I think. The questions we're asking are, what is it that we, you know, Jung talked about the collective unconscious long before epigenetics was part of the conversation. I gave a talk at Google a few days ago where one of the people in the audience said, do you think there's a cloud of human experience like the cloud? I loved that question so much I wanted to marry it. It was just, I love this idea that what we are trying to do technologically with our data, with storing our information, is what human beings really have long, maybe always, wanted to do with self-preservation and immortality and art that outlives us and, you know, objects that outlive us and, you know, the pharaohs and the tombs. I mean, all of it, we're trying to figure out what dies and what doesn't die. You know, what can be kept alive beyond our mortal coil? So this question of how is it that subsequent generations seem to know so much about things that happened before they were born. I think the investigation and the question is what's interesting, not so much the definitive conclusions that we may or may not come up with. But I do understand that people get pretty riled up about it. So I like this question too. What can children of survivors do to help survivors of more recent conflicts reduce negative effects on their current or future children? And that speaks really deeply to my heart about that sense of obligation and commitment to empathetically reaching out, especially in this moment, as I said, of such widespread trauma, but also looking back over our shoulders at recently traumatized or historically traumatized groups, my sense of connection with African Americans feels like it comes from a shared sense of centuries, millennia even, of being persecuted, of being prohibited from doing things or living places. Or, you know, the Jews and African Americans have a lot of history that we've shared in the civil rights movement and so on, but I think it goes deeper than that, into that feeling of we recognize in each other this sense of historical trauma that we carry in our bodies. And so when someone like Brian Stevenson, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the work that he's doing in the Equal Justice Initiative by placing plaques in the sites of lynchings in the South that specifically name the person who was lynched and where and when, he's actually echoing what is happening in Europe with the Stolpersteine, these bronzed or gold stones in sidewalks naming the names of victims and where they lived and where they died. Black Lives Matter, the naming of individual victims. Me too, similarly. I think we're trying to remember that these events kept happening to singular individual people, and they mustn't be erased by being gathered into numbers and sort of abstractions. So I think one of the things children of survivors can do is really practice deep listening and practice empathetic listening, and to recognize that we are affiliated by these shared histories. You know, I grew up often feeling like I was strange and kind of that most Jewish Jew thing in Electric City, but also that my history wasn't replicated in my peer group. And yet I think if we look harder, we can see that actually every one of us carries a complex historical trauma, and that can actually, we can help each other with those histories. We can help each other speak about them. We can help each other feel less alone in that experience.
Yeah, I would agree with Liz. I think for myself, I wish I could speak to more multicultural groups than I do. I mean, here we are in the JCC, and there are some people in the audience who are not Jewish, but most of the people in the audience are Jewish. And I tend to like to speak to people who aren't Jewish because they don't know my history generally, and many times they're able to see their own history better through my history. And I try, as Liz does, both of us not only write, but we do a lot of speaking, and sometimes we do teaching. And I've really gotten a huge response from individuals who come from, say, China, Maoist China, and are children of people who survived that period. Mm-hmm. I have talked to survivors of the Rwandan genocide. I've spoken at the Armenian Archdiocese in New York. I mean, they were the first people who invited me to speak when I wrote my book. But I have to say that for me personally, it's also extremely helpful to see my history in other populations.
It's been amazing to get to do this with you. I feel so privileged. You know, back from that moment when I was told that my book wasn't needed because Helen had already written hers, it really feels like an honor to be able to share our work in this kind of parallel way that we've been creating and developing our voices and our material for so many years. And thank you, Stephanie. Thanks, Jason. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were writers Helen Epstein and Elizabeth Rosner, talking about the intergenerational aftermath of genocide and how their families' pasts shaped their own lives and the writers that they became. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.